A quick note before we start. About 70% of all people who listen to the show on Apple or Spotify don't follow the podcast. If you like the show, please hit that follow button. It ensures that you don't miss an episode, and it really helps spread awareness of the conversations we're having. And if you can leave a comment or a rating, that's even better. Thank you. Okay, let's get back to the show.
I'm Andrew Kitley, and this is my podcast, The Invisible Gift, a show about turning disability into possibility. From a young age, I was told I had a disability that would make it impossible for me to achieve and flourish in life. I struggled in school and felt I was not truly understood or supported. On my long road to becoming the owner of multiple businesses, I have learned that dyslexia was not my disability, but rather my invisible gift. My dyslexia challenged me every day, but it was also what made me into an independent thinker, a creative, and gave me that hard-working mindset that has taught me to never be discouraged by failure. I realised there are many people out there just like me. So I wanted to learn more about them and how we can all transform our greatest challenge into our invisible gift. Welcome to my podcast.
Welcome back to another episode of The Invisible Gift.
Welcome back.
So last week on the show, Ben Cook joined us from EY, talking about his groundbreaking report, The Value of Dyslexia.
Yeah, and having Ben on was a real big win for me. It's great having a different view from a corporate environment.
If you haven't checked that episode out, absolutely go listen to it when you get a minute. This week on the show, you were joined by sales expert, motivational speaker, author, award-winning entrepreneur, Alison Edgar, MBE.
Yep, and I can see why she's got all that around her name, because she has an abundance of confidence that I really think everyone should witness.
So Alison has featured on the BBC, The Telegraph, The Guardian, the list goes on. She is dyslexic and has just recently authored her newest book, which is called Smash It, The Art of Getting What You Want.
Yeah, I know. What a great title for a book, right?
I think its essence is about revealing the key to realizing your dreams. Is that right?
Yeah, that's it. She believes that you look at it, manifest it, and you can become it. I've tried to throw some obstacles her way through the podcast, and she just smashes them out of the park. And the thing is, I think she's been in this arena so long that she has a very good answer for everything. And it was so great talking to her.
So in the episode, you talk, as you were saying earlier, about building confidence and how to build the confidence of neurodiverse children. Mm. You talk about if the education system is outdated, which is a topic that comes up in so many episodes. Yeah. And one of the reasons we started the podcast from the positivity perspective and how it's an invisible gift was that we wanted to try and move the narrative on from bashing the education system. Yeah. But interesting to hear what her thoughts on that are. And you also reveal the secret to getting what you want.
Yeah, which is a question that I'm asked all the time, and she brilliantly answers it.
But as always, you kicked off with finding out a bit more about Alison and her background.
Hi, Andrew. I'm Alison Edgar. So I'm now Alison Edgar MBE, believe it or not, because in the 2020 honours list, I got an honour from the Queen for the work I do in entrepreneurship and business.
Amazing.
Thank you. And, you know, as a dyslexic who left school at 16, I think it's one of those things that hopefully inspires other people to believe that they can achieve things that they probably never even thought was possible. I've also written two books. The first one was they've both been Amazon bestsellers, but the first one was a WH Smith top 10 business book as well, which was is called Secrets of Successful Sales. And then the one that I wrote during lockdown is Smash It, The Art of Getting What You Want. And I also run a training company called Smash It Training and Coaching, as well as speaking at events for big organisations like Discovery, EasyJet and Sky. So, yeah, that's a little bit about me.
Yeah, nice. That was clear. I like it. Well, actually, this could be a really good chat, because my favourite thing in the world is selling. And I always say to everyone, you sell every day of your life in every scenario, and I love sales. And that's basically what I do in my companies. I am the salesperson.
Yeah, and you know what? If you can sell, you can do anything. It's a life skill. So it's not just a business skill. But if you look at people going for interviews or, you know, just in different scenarios, and like, I've got a secret. It's a bit early in the interview to tell you this, but actually I prove at the end of Smash It, The Art of Getting What You Want, that everything is a sale, and I actually can evidence it. So yes, it's a skill that can really change your life, not just from a business perspective.
Yeah, and I completely agree with that. I can't think of one scenario that I've ever been in where some level of sales isn't required. And when I used to speak to kids, I used to teach martial arts, and when we used to ever talk about them, what they was going on to do when they're older, I always say, always get some experience in sales. So one of my first jobs, well, actually it was my first job, when I was I think I was 15 at the time, I had to sell a kitchen and bathrooms to people over the phone, which was an induction of fire into sales, phoning people at 7 o'clock at night, trying to sell them bedrooms and kitchens. I mean, bathrooms and kitchens was a bit harsh. All I got, you really learn how to deal with a nose in that scenario.
Yeah, it's the school of hard knocks, isn't it, Andrew? And I think it's interesting because with GDPR, you couldn't do that now. Things have changed so much, haven't they?
Yeah, can you imagine? Well, to be honest, as much as I love sales, I didn't really like that because the people were just like, I'm trying to eat my dinner every single phone call.
I know.
You're phoning me during dinner. Yeah. But it was.
But then it's interesting. I think that's one of the things that gives sales a bad name, Andrew. Sales has evolved so much since then. And I think there's still that legacy of like the pushy sales, the cold calls, the inconvenient time, the, you know, the Kirby salesmen, remember the Kirbys and all that sort of stuff, the door-to-door encyclopedias. And I think, you know, we're still living with that legacy of people who didn't really sell particularly well, which is what, you know, tarnishes everything, I think.
Yeah. Well, every time I talk to people about sales, they always go, oh, sleazy salesman. Even now, it's still there. And I was like, most times these days you don't realize we kind of teach by aligning ourselves with people, don't we? And that's how we do a lot of sales now. So obviously you're dyslexic. Tell us a bit about your background, how your education, how you found out you was dyslexic, and how you kind of started in your career.
Well, I didn't really know I was dyslexic. I just thought I was a bit thick, to be honest, Andrew, when I was at school. I didn't know any different. And you know, this was like the 80s when I was at school, and I can remember, you know, as you would go through an English class, that they would make you stand up and read Shakespeare or read a part of a book. And honestly, I even thinking about it now, I can still, you know, chase that fear in my mouth. And I'm like, maybe I should say I'm not feeling very well. And you're like always trying to get out of that scenario and the more pressure you're under, the more you read like you're 18 months old. And I didn't know. I didn't know dyslexia was a thing. And what happened, I was blessed with amazing parents. You know, Andrew, like literally my mum and dad just taught me to believe in myself and that academia wasn't everything. Like my sister was a straight A student. She went to uni. She's a pharmacist. But there's things that my mum and dad could see were a strength in me that my sister didn't have. And all they really cared about was, am I doing my best? Am I getting up every day, bringing my A game and doing my best? And they sort of helped me to focus on the things which, like, I'm good at. Like, I really love people. I build relationships really quickly. You know, I'm loyal, I'm honest, I'm trustworthy. And all those things were the things they said, look, just focus on the things that you're great at. And I can remember when I sat my O-levels, so this is, you know, 15, 16, and my sister, again, had gone through the straight A's, you know, the highers, the this. And, like, you know, she'd have had a couple of cards, you know, from people to say congratulations. I got a C for my arithmetic. Not even maths, Andrew, a C for arithmetic. And there was cards everywhere. There was phone calls. Everybody was really tough. So it was a bit like expectation management. But that then led me to know that I wasn't, you know, I had to get out of school as soon as I could. And I ended up getting a job in a hotel as a hotel receptionist. And again, it really played to my strengths. And I didn't know much about what a hotel receptionist did. I thought you just gave out the keys, checking in, checking out. I thought, oh, I'd be really good at that, checking in and out. What I didn't realise was you were actually in charge of every single piece of cash that came through the hotel. And at that time, oh, I'm showing my age, there was no computers. It was all done in a manual tab. So you had to get your rubber and use your columns. And actually, the skills that I learned at such a young age are the skills that you need for business. So that they stead, you know, they kept me in really good stead. So I sort of grew my career in the hotel industry, and I worked again. I think because my mum and dad had believed in me so much, it gave me that inner confidence to believe that I could actually achieve, no matter the fact that I couldn't read and write particularly well. So yeah, and then I worked in Cape Town, I worked in Sydney, I worked in the States, I worked in the Channel Islands, and I just really stuck to an industry where it didn't really matter that much whether my reading or writing was great, because I could always focus on my strength, and my strength is people. So I think that's where the journey really started from, was taking, you know, not focusing on the things I'm not great at and really honing right in on the things that I'm brilliant at.
That's interesting. You've got, so there's a few things you've said there which I love, and we're gonna go into them a little bit. Because one of the conversations I keep having with people that are in the dyslexia space, and not necessarily dyslexic people, but people who either educate or try to help people with dyslexia, and you said about your parents gave you confidence. I had a conversation yesterday with someone about bringing confidence along in children, and the person I'm speaking to says that children struggle a lot with the confidence when they have dyslexia, because the failure is quite often, and it's very hard to build that into them. Now, you're in the same situation as me. My parents, the best gift my parents ever gave me was confidence. My mum and dad are both the most confident people I know. And they were both on the believing that if you're confident, there's not anything you can't achieve. For people that don't have parents like that, how do you think, or what is your opinion on, when children are younger, having some sort of confidence building classes? Is there a way to do that, do you think?
I think it's imperative. I think it's something that should be in the curriculum. And if you look at, I know that especially in the primary schools, they're doing a lot of work around the Carol Dweck studies on fixed and growth mindset. And I think that's a brilliant addition to the curriculum. But I do think, again, there's still a lot of pressure for academic results and Ofsted results. And, you know, I think that they're not building time into the curriculum for that. But I think it's, and again, if you look at things like the CBT method, you know, again, what you think is, it leads to how you feel and how you behave, that it's actually changing those thoughts at source, you know, and really getting kids to actually vocalise, I can't read, I can't write, I can't do this, I can't stand up and speak in public, and go, yay, because that's where you've got to start from. And instead of going, oh, yes, you can, really work with them and going, right, okay, why do you think that? You know, what are, again, it's a bit of sales, Andrew. It's just like sales. You know, why do you think that? What's the blocker? And again, because they feel that, they're getting really anxious. And when they're anxious, then they'll shy away from it because they'll worry about failure. But it's really, again, bringing that growth mindset in to go, right, great, that's amazing. You failed. What have you learned from this? And it's putting those building blocks on failure that really lead to that confidence and not being afraid to fail. And I think that's where, you know, if you look at a lot of people, you know, and it's, I tell you what's really interesting. So it's interesting, my journey as a dyslexic and having gone through with my parents, but both my children are dyslexic. And as a parent, that's quite hard to support because you feel like going, of course you can read that word. Of course you can do that. And, you know, and then you go, oh, no, they're doing their best. They're doing their best. And it's hard because you always kind of want better for your children. So, you know, I wanted my children to get academic results. I wanted them to go to uni. I want all that stuff. But actually, I was kind of, like, do as I say, not as I do. And it was like, it took me a wee while to get my head around it, that when it's your own kids, it's so I think, again, your parents and my parents deserve a medal for actually thinking the way they thought and not, you know, fitting that mould of, you know, oh, you need to get an A star or, oh, you need to. And I think the other thing is like the vocational courses, like the trades, the hairdressing, the plumbing, the electricals, you know what I mean? Like all that stuff, like those are the core foundations for commerce in the UK, and yet so many people look down on those trades. And actually, that's where the neurodiverse tend to gather, because they're great problem solvers, they're really creative. And I think, again, it's you know, we don't all have to go to university, we all don't have to get degrees, but, you know, really value people for the strengths that they bring.
Well, yeah, and I agree with that. Coming from someone from construction, I started off my adult career as a scaffolder. And it's quite funny because a lot of people, you kind of look down at all the tradies, as we're called, about what we do. And you just think, now as a structural engineer, I realise that it's all these people that build everything, all the infrastructure, the places we live, everything is, everyone's cogs in a very important role. And I think the problem is we put emphasis on roles that don't really mean anything. And I find my friends who do the building jobs tend to, when they get older, feel more fulfilled in their lives than people that just, my friends who started their careers in offices are now, we sit around tables and they're like, oh, I wish I actually done a trade, because it was out, it actually feels tangible, like you're achieving something and all these sort of things. And I said, the thing is, we're kind of pushed into office jobs as much as possible, and I see it even more. And in the last couple of seasons, all we've talked about is people doing incredible things with dyslexia and moving on from their education. But I talked to a kid yesterday who's dyslexic, and he's about to leave school, and he asked me why education is still the way it is when nothing's the same as it used to be. And do you know what? I didn't actually have an answer for him. So maybe a wiser person with an MBE could give a...
Yeah, but you know what? That's quite interesting. I've been speaking to a lady who's in the process of setting up her own senior school, and I think it is entrepreneurial people. We know, we're problem solvers. That's our, like, well, hey, go us. We don't see the barrier. We just see that, oh, yeah, just go round to the left, round to the right, and we'll get where we want. That's, you know, that's our special gift, isn't it? We are brilliant at solving problems. And I think that you can, you know, if a lot of the education has been run by non-dyslexics, so they just say, ah, we've always done it that. And it's a lot of fixed mindset, whereas actually it's a bit like Montessori education, isn't it? Like, you're getting people that are shaking up education and setting up their own schools, their own academies. And that's what it will take. I think it's, you know, literally people standing up to it, whereas people are scared, aren't they? They're scared to, like, go against the grain because they'll lose their job. And again, a lot of that fits into Maslow's hierarchy of needs. They don't want to shake the boat because they might lose their job, and then they lose their house, and then they can't put food on the table. So they just go with the same as it has been. But I do think, you know, entrepreneurial people are, a high percentage of them dyslexic, that they will eventually stand up and go, right, it's our time to shake this education. You know, we were failed by the education system. Let's get together and change it. And I can see movements again. You know, a prime example is, you know, a lady who is setting up a school. Her son's dyslexic. She's going through a really tough time with him in mainstream education. And she's like, if I can save, you know, not save one child, but if I can help one child who has got neurodiversity to do things differently, then I'm going to create this school. I'm going to get funding. I'm going to do this. So it's amazing. Like, I think there's, I do agree that, and again, I've probably been called, you know, all the names under the sun, but, like, why are we still reading Shakespeare? Like, for a dyslexic, that's just, like, literally Chinese. It's like, we can't even read, and then you can't make sense of the words. They're jumping all over the page, and yet we're being judged on that academically by something that, a language which is so old-fashioned that nobody even speaks it anymore. So, you know, I think there's a lot of work should be done in there. And again, we need somebody with an MBE for education to get in there and give it an old shufty around. I'll tell you one of the things, it's really interesting. I like desert island discs, right? It's on my goal board. I really want to be on desert island discs. And I go through the sort of back catalogue. There's so many of them. And like last night, I listened to John Bishop, the comedian, and Hilary DeVay, the entrepreneur. But at the end of the episode, what I do is I'll go back and I think, right, John, he was married to his wife, Melanie. He nearly got divorced. And then he came back up again. He's got three kids. One's called Luke. One's called Jamie. One of them's a dancer. You know, this is what happened. These were his songs. So I can tell you off pat everything that happened on that desert island disc. Whereas if actually somebody, you know, if I was writing that down, I wouldn't remember any of it. I think that's, again, our real strength, that especially when it's around people, you know, we've got, for me specifically, I love people. So I genuinely, when they talk, I'm listening to what they're saying and I'm really interested. And yeah. I think that's a skill that I've honed because I've had to compensate. I suppose it's a bit like, you know, if you get a disability in your hand or whatever, you use the other one to make up for yeah. it. Well, I know that I've got a hidden disability in my life, so I use all the other things just to whack it all out. And people go, oh, you've got a great memory. Oh, it's because I'm really interested, and because the way my brain works, I can retain that information around people. So it's not it's a gift, it's a skill. But so many people, again, that are not dyslexic, do not have that, and they're relying on those notes. We don't need them. We've got a head that remembers all that stuff.
Yeah, and that's. Do you find your skills with people allows you to? The one thing people say, I'm really good with people, but I also see through bullshit a lot easier than most other people. And my friends hate it. They're like, it's like you've got an alarm, and they said you can see it in your face. I'll be like, yeah, yeah. And then when they say something, I'm like, as if to say, no, come on now, be serious, be honest. And do you kind of have that like bullshit radar?
Especially in business. So at the moment, there's a lot of, obviously you're in construction, so I don't know the different facets of businesses that you interact with. But for me, obviously I've got a training company and I do coaching, and there's loads of this. Do you want to make seven-figure business? Do you want to be a millionaire? I should do this in the coaching space. And like all these people are getting really sucked in and going, oh my God, if I just follow this process, then I too can be a millionaire. And I'm like, this is a load of pyramid BS. How they make their money is they teach you how to make money. They charge you so that you can charge other people. And that's how it goes. And there was like somebody the other day, literally had a conversation just before I came on to you. And this person is the life coach to Oprah. And I'm like, really? Really? You know, you might have a photo, but really? And I think it's that kind of stuff. And it's not that I don't, you know, I think we've got, again, I think it's another thing with the dyslexia, because it's like our superpower, isn't it? We have to hone in on the things that we really, because a lot of the detailed sort of stuff just like goes over the top of our head. So we hone in on the things and actually listening to what people say and you know, really, you have to. And I think that's one of the things that you can pick up, especially when people are changing their stories. And that's where the people with the BS tend to change their stories quite a lot. And really?
You must find it must be hard in your arena, because so I started my personal development journey in 2007, I think it was, 2007-ish. Jesus, that was a long time now. And when I started going through it, first of all, I went through learning about property, and actually learning, going to property networking events is actually what got me into personal development. Then that got me into sales and learning about people skills. And then you kind of learn things like NLP, which a lot of people slag off, but I actually quite liked NLP. And you learn all these different things. And I went through hundreds of books to learn about the different stages. But in you're right. All you hear now is get rich quick schemes. And my friends come to me because obviously I have businesses, and they always seek advice, and they show me these deals and they're like, what do you think of this? And I'm like, no, it's a load of crap. And they're like, yeah, but they said, like, there's one that always comes up to me on YouTube. It's this woman trying to sell, I don't know, Amazon businesses, ideas or something. And she always goes, oh, I made seven figures this year. And I was like, no, you didn't. Do you know why you didn't? Because if you did, you'd be happy and content, and you wouldn't be training other people how to do it. It's rubbish. And if you were,
it's a load of nonsense.
It must be hard, because that's kind of like, as soon as you say training, people go, do you find it's hard?
For me, no, because I think I differentiate. So for a lot of the stuff that I do, and again, it's really interesting because I've never read a personal development book in my life. I've never read a business book in my life. I got invited to this how to be a public speaker course by one of my friends. And I'm like, yeah. I'm was like, I think I'm quite good at this. I don't need a course. I'm like, oh, you can always learn something else. And then what I realized, it was like a honey trap, the run to the back, pay me loads of money, you can make money as a speaker. So, you know, that was my sort of first experience into any of that space. And it was just filthy dirty. I was like, oh my God, this is just a big pyramid. This is disgusting. So touch wood, like I don't do sort of standalone coaching, and I'll only work with about 6 clients in total. I don't, like, that's not how I monetize. So I've got a training company, so I won't work with individuals. There's no run to the back. It'll be like, so say, for example, it's a mortgage advisor company, and they've got 10 guys on the phones. I'll go in and I'll run the courses for them. So I'm only purely working business to business that I've got employees. So there might be like your team of 12, couple of guys on the phone, or I'm known as the entrepreneur's godmother as well. So some of the startups that I work with, you know, I've worked with these young entrepreneurs when they were like, well, one of them was 15, one of them was 18, the other one was 20. And I've been working with them for 7 years, and I've been, you know, they've literally grown, not in any personal development space. Like, one's got a flood defense company, the other one's got an app for well-being, the other one has now got an estate agents and stuff like that. So they're not at all in a service business, and I keep away from it. And I think it's, for me, it's quite easy. I'm never, there's like a group of people, as you know, run to the back. Here we are. Do you want to make money from property? Look at me, I'm a millionaire. Do you want to do this? I'm a millionaire. Come on my courses. I can't stand that. And there's a group of people that I cannot, like, I do Clubhouse, and I can't even be in the same Clubhouse room because it taints my brand. I can't be in there because people think that it's like tacit approval, isn't it? That I'm approving of this stuff, and I have no. And the thing with it is, I'm not saying, especially in the property space, I think there is money to be made in property. But all this, like, upsell, you know, come on this course, and then I'll sell you the 5 grand package, and then I'll sell you the 20 grand package. And they're not making money from the properties. That's not how they're monetizing. They're making it from, and again, people fundamentally are quite greedy, aren't they? And they're like, that's, you know, and again, it comes back to the Maslow's thing. A lot of the time, they prey on the broken, that they're going through a divorce, or they're in a bereavement state, or they've lost their job, and they've got the redundancy, and they're in that inner turmoil. And again, whether they're dyslexic or not dyslexic, a lot of the time it's through, because again, sometimes people who are more academic will question more on the detail. Whereas I think sometimes as dyslexic, we're sort of taken in by the whole woo and not the detail. And I think that's where they're exploiting people who are either not particularly academic or who are going through a turmoil phase in their life, and they screw them for cash. And then they say, oh yeah, but it's your fault you didn't take action. And it's just, it's vile. In fact, to the extent that I'm working with government, I'm working with the APS, which is like the Institute for Sales. And we're looking at how we can regulate this stuff, because that I'm so anti it. And sadly, there's like a group of about 10 names in that space that are just, you know, and they're idolized. People idolize them. And it's just like, can you not see? Can you not see? And again, coming back to that BS, you know, radar, a lot of people just can't see it.
No.
So interesting what Alison was saying there about those charlatans and motivational gurus that take advantage of vulnerable people through business courses.
Yeah, I mean, we've all seen one of them. Run to the back, quick.
Alison also mentioned on the show that she worked with the APS, the Institute for Sales, to try and bring some regulation into the space. What was your take on that?
I completely agree with it, because unfortunately the best thing about some salespeople, and this is definitely, I used to be a salesperson, definitely not all salespeople, but the thing they're very good at is parting you with your money. And there are people out there that will absolutely stitch up the most vulnerable people, and that's normally people that don't actually have money and want to make an improvement in their life. Unfortunately, this opens the world to them, and you have to, I don't think it's a bad thing to make sure that they don't do that.
Hi everyone, I just have a quick announcement that I'm really excited to share. We're launching the Invisible Gift Community, a platform designed to provide support and resources for neurodivergent individuals. I've always been passionate about sharing conversations around being neurodivergent, raising awareness and promoting understanding important, but I want to do more. So now the Invisible Gift website will offer a range of tools and resources to help neurodivergent individuals navigate the challenges any one of us can face on a daily basis. This includes information about workplace accommodations, tips for managing sensory overload, advice on how to communicate effectively, information for how to get the most out of a neurodivergent child's education, as well as providing the building blocks for them to have a successful life and much more. But to do this, we need your input. We are looking for therapists, influencers, business leaders, HR, and brand representatives to provide their input and support. If you're one of these people that wants to support neurodivergence, or if you just believe you can really help out, send my team an email on hello@theinvisiblegift.com and you can find more information on the Invisible Gift website. With your help, we can really turn neurodiversity into possibility. Okay, back to the show.
Coming up, you guys talk about why you need to make yourself happy first before you can make anybody else happy. And Alison shares with you her invisible gift.
Yep, exciting, because I'm all about self-awareness and Alison could not agree more with me on this.
But before you talked about Alison's invisible gift, you were talking about why it's important and if there aren't enough people now working in those, like the first entry-level job that you often have when you're growing up. So for you, it was a job in a supermarket. For others, it might be a retail or customer service role.
Yeah, that's so important to have that breadth of understanding from different areas. And you can, the great thing about them companies is you can always work in different parts of them. And that really helps you understand what you're good at. And I think that's important for everyone.
Let's pick the conversation back up with you talking about what young people lose when they don't have that experience.
You mentioned earlier about small jobs you've done that helped you, like working in the hotel and greeting people. I worked in Asda after the sales thing, and I always found it really helped me grow. Do you think there's not enough emphasis around taking on smaller jobs as a stepping stone? Do you feel like these days, particularly younger people, when I speak to them, they want to try and jump into the job straight away? Not just young people, actually. I know adults that do want to do that as well. But the smaller steps are always the better ones to take, I feel.
Yeah, but I think, again, it comes back to that instant gratification, like you're ordering, here's my Deliveroo, it's here in half an hour, here's my Amazon, it's here tomorrow. You know, we are now in a society that we don't want to wait for anything tomorrow, we want it all yesterday. And I think that's the same with career. But again, it's interesting working with young people, because I employ young people, that's what I do. And you know, it sounds really bad, Andrew, don't take this the wrong way, but I kick them out after a couple of years because the world is too small, you know, the world is too big for them to be working for me for the rest of their life. So, you know, some of the team, I've got one in Canada, one in Australia, one's in Portugal, and I think I love to give them that skill, but I do think that you will learn more. And then when you do go for the big job, you'll have more world and life experience, whereas actually, you know, it's harder to get into those top roles without that experience, isn't it?
Yeah, I said on one of my previous podcasts, so I'll try not to repeat myself too much, but my father-in-law used to be in the print business, and he said there was a rule in the print business. You take on an apprentice, they do 2 years training there, and then they had to leave. And the reason why is they left and went to another company and they learned completely new skills at another company. But that company also benefited from what other companies done. Therefore, the whole industry raised as a higher standard. And I thought that was an amazing thing. And I spoke to my dad, who used to be a mechanic and a panel beater, and he said that it was very similar for him as well. You only ever stayed somewhere for a couple of years and then you moved on and grew as a result of it. And I always say to all my team, never feel worried about if you feel like it's time to move on, never. So I know a lot of people panic about handing in their notice and moving on, but you know, there's always people move around, so you can always bring more people on board. And an employer should be happy that you found another place where you want to work, not sad. You said something earlier which I have brought up on a lot of my podcasts. I think it's a good point to raise, is kind of self-reflection, knowing oneself. How can I remember this? As I don't know who said it to me, so I can't say who they are, but someone said to me, I was moaning once about a situation, and they said to me, before you look without, maybe you should look within. And that's kind of like how from a nice human being point of view, that's actually a good point to make anyway. But then I started looking at that in business. You know, when something goes wrong, or you're saying it's not right, or saying it's not working, it's easy to blame, become a victim of what's happened, rather than looking at it and saying, well, what did I do to contribute to that? Where did, because it is a two-person dance or multiple persons, and it's not just, it's easy to blame someone else. So what I started doing was looking at all the stuff, you know, if I missed deadlines on something I was going to do for the business, why is that deadline being missed? Well, I prioritized this over for no reason. So I procrastinated here. I didn't do that. Why did I do these things? And then I realized that that's, once I found my flaws, I knew what I either had to improve or outsource. And actually, most of the stuff at that point, I'd already outsourced most of the stuff I needed to. So all me. And like you said, it's great in an organization, but we live in a world where we don't encourage people to actually look at their own thoughts related to what's going on, but kind of like look at everything else instead.
Yeah, but I think that comes back to that superpowers and vulnerabilities, that, you know, it's important that you don't, you know, nobody's perfect. Nobody's a 5 out of 5 for everything in their life. And if you think you're a 5 out of 5, then that says more about the person that thinks they're a 5 out of 5 than the other people. But I think it's, I mean, when I wrote Smash It, I mean, this was the interesting thing, because when I wrote Secrets of Successful Sales, that was quite easy to write because it was the core content that I teach, right? So four key pillars: behaviours, sales process, sales strategy, and confidence. That it wasn't a difficult book to write because it's what I teach. But what was happening, people were reading Secrets of Successful Sales and they were coming back to me and saying, oh my, I love that book, Alison. It's amazing. I'm getting on better with my husband now, or I love that book. I've just bought a house and I've managed to save a few £1,000 on it because I negotiated on it, or I've done this and I've done that. And I'm like, oh no, oh no. And literally that was my whole, I'm going to have to write another book now, because actually the techniques in that book, it from a personal development perspective, then actually I can help, because like Jane from Bognor, that's not getting on very well with a teenage son, is not going to pick up Secrets of Successful Sales, whereas Jane from Bognor actually will want to smash it. Like, who in their life does not want to smash it and get what they want? Everyone wants that. So I had to rewrite like a lot of the stuff, but because I've never invested in personal development, I've never read a personal development book, I really had to search so hard into, you know, I'm notorious for getting what I want all the time. So what did I do? But not only what did I do, but the case studies in the book, you know, there's all these case studies of people that have used my methods to get what they want. And I was like, oh no. And honestly, at the end of it, and it's a chunky book, it's 71,000 words. Secrets of Successful Sales was only 43. This one's like more or less double the size. And I literally at the end of it was like, hallelujah, hallelujah, I've discovered the meaning of life. And that's what it feels like, you know, writing that book for me, you know, self-awareness, inner social comparisons, like all these things. Again, they're not new theories, but the way that I feel that I put it together like a jigsaw puzzle, if people follow it, then they will get what they want and they'll smash it. So, and I know for a fact, because I've had the feedback from this book that people are loving it, so it's great.
Yeah, it's always nice. I like in books when they give examples of people that have actually used it and done well, because I think that's always quite a nice section to add.
Yeah, and I think the other thing with Smash It was, for the neurodiverse, we find reading hard, right? There's that. There's no beating about the bush on that. Like, a dyslexic finds it hard. So there was two things that I took, two things for the team, Andrew. Two things, not just one thing. Two things for the team. So the first one, right, it's not bad enough as a dyslexic writing a book. I narrated both the books for Audible. So thank the Lord I had a great editor, because literally I have to read a sentence at a time. We just had to, like, and in my head, if I got to a paragraph without making a mistake, I was dead excited. Oh my God, I got a paragraph. And then I'd lose the track, and then I'd make a mistake, and then he'd be like, no, that's not the right word. Start again. And again, it took me 3 days solid in the studio. But then the other thing, which again is a really good thing for people with dyslexia, I invested in an app. So Smash It has actually got an app because there's tasks in the book. So yeah. When it comes to the part, say it's a goal set and vision boards, you know, whatever it is, you go to the app and you've got me on video and I'm like, right, do this, do that. So again, I think as somebody that's dyslexic, having that additional little audio side of things or visual side of things, which we know again are the things from the creative that we love, just that like a blended learning approach was something that I decided to do specifically for people with dyslexia.
Yeah, but see, so for me, that's thinking about the people that are going to be consuming something you've created. I have a continued issue with people who produce books or anything for dyslexic people that don't put it in an audible way, because I always say to people, I read 60 books a year approximately. I love reading. I love listening. I don't read any books. I listen to books. If they're not on audible, I won't read them.
I think it makes a difference though. And I think, you know, that's the thing, like if you're going to say you're going to do something, do it, genuinely care. And I think, you know, for me, that's one of the things, you know, coming back to the BS radar, you know, I've got no skeletons in the cupboard. So I'm very vocal about my opinions. So, yeah. And it's that genuineness of why you do what you do. And I think it's, you know, for me, that's one of my values that's really, really, really important. And again, I do believe that's why I got the MBE. You don't get an MBE for the, you know, being the richest person in the room, the smartest person in the room. It's for services too. And it's the work that I've done for entrepreneurship and business that's given me that accolade.
That must have been amazing. I'm a bigger royal family lover, so something like that must have been incredible for you.
I couldn't believe it. Literally, I can't say that the best day of my life, because then, you know, obviously my wedding day and the days that my children were born.
Yeah, they're fine. Just say it's the best day of your life.
best day of my life. But you know, the thing with it is, I think when you're not expecting it, and again, coming from a humble background, you know, I was brought up in a high-rise council flat in Clydebank, just outside Glasgow. Like, people know Clydebank for the QE2 and wet, wet, wet. So, you know, I'm and Duncan Bannatyne, I'm probably the fourth most famous thing from Clydebank there. So,
that's brilliant. There's a lot of talk about neurodiversity right now. It seems to be, I don't know if you would agree with this, but it seems like it's gone from 0 to 100 in the last couple of years, and it's only, if anything, only growing the conversations, which is great. However, when I speak to younger people, they don't see it. It's not as obvious to them because they're not in corporate environments where we all talk about not just neurodiversity, diversity as a whole is a big conversation at the moment. But I feel like they're not seeing that side. So I spoke to a few people about, We whenever you mention a dyslexic person, everyone says Richard Branson, like Whoopi Goldberg. It's always the same names that get trotted out. And to be honest, Richard Branson's obviously an amazing guy and still doing amazing things, but is this the person that would align with younger people at school now? And there's so many talented, but what also the problem is comparing yourself to Richard Branson is a very hard comparison. And actually insane when you think about it. It's as insane as comparing a millionaire to a billionaire, which is basically what you'll be doing. So how do we kind of put ourselves as people that have done well with dyslexia and don't see it as an obstacle at all? How do we kind of share our successes with younger people?
I do think a lot of that comes back to the education, because I mean, one of my give backs is I go in and I work with secondary schools, and I hate to use the term, but like the ones that have been in a bit of trouble, the ones that and again, a lot of that stems from playing up in the classroom because of dyslexia and the neurodiversity, and that's their coping mechanism. So you know, I think it's about people who have been diagnosed who do that, to actually go back in and speak to them, not just about dyslexia, but the possibilities that they can have in their life. But I think it's brilliant, you know, the diversity and inclusion conversations in big organisations, and that's where they will feel the benefit when they go into the workplace, but they don't know what they don't know. They don't know what it was like before. So for them, that we want that to be the normal. And, you know, even I was speaking to somebody at Morgan Stanley, I think it was. There's a lady that I know from like some of the women in sales events. Actually, JP Morgan, it was JP Morgan. Mm-hmm. And she asked me to speak to one of the guys in her team who's on like a fast track, but he's dyslexic. And he's like, I'm really worried and how it's perceived. And I'm like, I mean, things like now having your signature, if you look at like an LGBTQ perspective, which I'm an ally for LGBTQ, but as a dyslexic trying to say that is really hard. You've got the flag on your signature so that people know. And again, I think it's like now in the larger organization, you can have your hidden disability on your signature as well. So if there is a grammar mistake in it or there is a spelling mistake in it and you can't see that, because some of the times like we don't even know where to start on some of the words, and it doesn't matter what tools you've got, it just doesn't land. But actually, if you got that, you wouldn't think, oh, they're really stupid, or they're grammar, or they're lazy, or they're whatever. But oh, actually, they've got dyslexia, oh, that's great. And you would ignore it. So I think that actually, a lot of the stuff happens, if it happens in the big organisations, it tends to roll its way down. So I think that's where working on change in large organisations will benefit everybody, because that will become the normal and the standard.
Yeah, that's what I spoke about on my last podcast, about how big organisations will be the change makers of dyslexia, because government can't and don't have the finances to really make that much change, and they don't have the power to influence big organisations. So once the big organisations make it, the government will be able to implement more things, and I think that's going to be the positive side of it. So it is good hearing it, but the conversation I keep having with younger people is they're like, oh yeah, we hear about all these amazing actors and talented people right at the top, but where's Darren down the road, you know, who's dyslexic but actually done quite well for himself, he's got a good job, he's got a great family, he's done well, where's that person? And I feel like sometimes
but I think that's where, you know, like in life, I talk at the bank of cash, the bank of give back, and the bank of faffing around, really like the things that make your heart sing. And I think that's what, for me, is the balance in my life. Like, I love my life. There's not a day that I get out of bed and go, oh, I need to do that again today. I love it. So, but a lot of that is feeding the bank of give back. Is Darren so busy trying to do the bank of cash and on the hamster wheel that he's not got time to give back? Because that's our school's engaging with Darren to say, oh, Darren, do you fancy coming in? And like, we've got this wee group, and could you do a wee session on what you know, how you overcame your hidden disability to get this great job? So I think it's a two-way street, but Darren's got to want to go in, and actually the schools have got to reach out to Darren, who's probably a former pupil, and getting them back. But I think sometimes in schools, once you're off the radar, you're off the radar. So I think, you know, that's how you get that younger generation in to talk to them, is get them to go back and do a give back as a former pupil.
I like your candidness. It's quite interesting, because normally when I ask questions to people, they can kind of avoid it, but you just say what you think, which is quite nice. I like that. So I'll ask you another question, seeing as you're hitting the hard ones out of the park. So do you think, now this is obviously slightly off neurodiversity, and because we're covering things that isn't just for neurodiverse people, it's just for people generally, which is obviously what you do. You don't just specialise in neurodiverse people. But do you think that maybe our views these days for all ages, not just younger people, I see it with certainly people around my age, and I'm 38, is our view of happiness is skewed too far into money and what other people's perceive we're going through, rather than what happiness really is?
I think that it's not just a recent thing. I think if you go back to the 40s, right, people were happy if they had a pair of stockings that had a line up the back, or a pencil that looked like a line up the back, and they got a chocolate bar and a banana. Woohoo! Everyone was happy, because the expectation post-war was a banana and a pair of stockings and, you know, a wee bit of time with your family. I just think as society has become more affluent, because if you look actually like post-war, we are, as a nation, we are quite affluent. And that's where that expectation of, oh, you know, you have to have a Mac, you have to have a PlayStation, you have to have that. That's where the divide comes, I think. And if you look you know, you've got the rich who are very affluent, and then you've got the middle class who are aspiring to be very affluent. And then you've got the working class who, again, a lot of them are in that neurodiverse space because, you know, they've not had that luxury of being able to get a job that pays them. And you look at things like the payday loans. And again, it comes back to that manipulation of that bracket and that band. And I think it's just so wrong. And that's unfortunately where a lot of the neurodiverse sit, that have got no confidence in themselves.
I completely get that. I think for me, I always say, when because I talk about money a lot, and I say to people, the thing is, I don't want money to buy more. Money is a form of measuring what I'm doing. There's lots of different ways of measuring. In business, money is the best form of how you're, for me, how you're doing, and how all you've got is money and how happy the staff are. That's the two kind of measurements I base the success, and how happy your clients are, obviously. But for I keep on saying, the problem was when I grew up, and this is now going to grow up, phones only come in when I was 14. The first time anyone got a phone was when I was 14, which makes me sound ancient. But there was if you were going to compare yourself to someone, you could only compare to someone in your school or lived on your road or in your group of friends. But now you have this, you are sitting there, and I say not just kids, this is probably worse with adults, if I'm honest. You're seeing all these people from across the planet in life situations which you don't know how they got there or anything, and you're taking it all out of context and you're comparing it to your life. Well, they're 4 years younger than me, and they've got all this, they've done that, and you don't know what's going on because it's curated to a certain way. And I think this is what, for me, breeds a lot of this is why the growth of mental health issues is becoming worse.
Oh, completely. I mean, I talk about that in Smash It, like the social comparison theory. And if you look, actually, like in some ways, like you look at a sales perspective, Andrew, like we both come from the world of sales. So you look at the league table, for example, and there was somebody above you, actually, you would work that wee bit harder to try and catch up. Mm. But now it's the other reverse. If you're like looking at somebody and you're thinking they've got the car, they've got the body, they've got the life, they've got the money, it actually makes you feel rubbish, doesn't it? Really doesn't help how you think. And I think, I mean, the other thing in this balance, like part of the reason I felt qualified to write Smash It, like I've been with Neil since, well, he's a toy boy, Andrew. He was 24 and I was 27. So, you know, I've got kind of like, I don't know, nearly 30 years under my belt with the same person. And and let's face it, relationships are at the core of happiness, aren't they? And, you know, I'm not saying that relationship with Neil has been a barrel of laughs. Do you know what I mean? There's been lots of laughs, but it's like, you know, up and down, like any relationship, but you have to work really, really, really hard. And I think that's where a lot of people, and I'm not saying it's like the 50s, oh, you should stick with that person for the rest of your life. I'm not saying that, but maybe wait and choose the right one rather than choosing the wrong one, just to be in a relationship as well. That for me, and again, I know there's obviously lots of facets to that we could talk about that one all day, but really that understanding, you know, I think is really important. Because I do think that, you know, and I think this is really interesting because, again, this is something that came up when we're writing the book, because a lot of people think that they can't be happy without that other half of a person that makes them a whole. But actually, happiness is not about that. You know, you've got to be happy, 100% happy in yourself. And the other person that you're with them because you want to be with them, not because you need to be with them. Because in theory, we don't need anybody. We come into the world on our own. We're going to go out on our own. We have to make that happiness ourselves. And so many people rely on somebody else to make them happy. That's what makes them unhappy, because other people are not going to make you happy. Make yourself happy. And funnily enough, people will congregate around happy people. So I think that's where there's that blame culture. Oh, they should be making me happy. No. Shouldn't it be making you happy? Make yourself happy and then be with them. So that's my thoughts behind that.
Yeah, I always say there's nothing more attractive than a person that's very happy and doing what they love. You always say that. You ever seen a person?
But that comes back to confidence, doesn't it? That comes back to that inner confidence. And, you know, I tell you, I think this is really interesting. Again, we're kind of going back around in this circle again around confidence. because I look now, and if I'm working with an organization, a sales team, then I can come in and I'll go, yeah. So what's the needs? What's the main thing they're struggling with? Honestly, if I had a pound for every single time they said confidence, I wouldn't need to work. I'd be in my villa in the south of France. So I think it's not just a, you know, a new thing. I think it's an actual worldwide, that's a pandemic that loads of people are lacking in confidence. Yeah. That's, you know, we need to do something with that at an earlier age, which is what you asked me at the start of the interview.
Yeah. And you're right. If I always say the one thing that changed is confidence, and people then go, how do you get confidence? And then that comes back into what we're saying about knowing yourself and kind of being complete on your own. I always say, if people are saying you're one half and your partner's another half, if you're not a complete half and you meet a partner, you're still empty at some point, and it just creates loads of problems. I've been with my wife for 15 years now. We met when she was 19, and we had a very happy relationship. We moved out, and we could have killed each other. It was awful for 5 years, and anyone that knew us could have seen that it was so hard. But, and also when I started the personal development and all the kind of big change in my life, leaving scaffolding and going back to university and then all these sort of things, she felt I was going in a completely different direction and we weren't the same people anymore. And we nearly split up at that, and we sat down and had a conversation. And bear in mind, we were still so young, and said, well, there's two options. Will you either come on the journey with me if you want to, or we split up and, you know, go our own separate way? And she said, well, why don't I try and come on the journey? And she was reading the stuff, some of the stuff I was reading, and we spoke about goals and everything like that, and she decided to come on the journey, and we've never happy since that, because we both have the same vision and goals and what we want to do.
I think that is.
My daughter's 14 weeks now.
Ah, congratulations.
Thank you. And that was a 5 years journey of nearly 20 odd operations, because she had problems, and then we had IVF and all stuff like that. And we said all the stuff, a lot of people ask us how we maintained happiness through that. And we had a miscarriage as well. And I said, the thing is, my happiness, I'm always happy with my situation. I love what I do. Every morning I get up, I'm excited. And I love seeing her when I come home. And it's got all these different things. And it doesn't matter if something goes wrong. There's so many other things that I'm happy about in my life. And I think that comes from the confidence and the happiness.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is you focus on the things you can control, not the things you can't. Ah. If you look at people who are struggling with unhappiness, it's again, I wish the world was flat. I wish, you know, I had more money. I wish I had that. I wish I had that. You know, they're not focusing on the things that they can control. And I think that's where mentally, when you focus on the things you can't control, it eats you up. And that affects your confidence.
And you're completely right. That is the one thing that we say about anything. We only ever worry about things that we can control if we're trying to change them and not happening. Anything within our control, anything else, we can't do anything. All we can do is make the best situation of it. What would you say your invisible gift is then?
I think my invisible gift is translating things that are a load of gobbledygook and making it be a language that everybody understands. And I think today you've probably experienced that, because there's a lot of things that people make it sound really complicated. I cut through all the noise and I go, actually this. And people go, oh yeah, you're right, that. So I think I'm a translator of gobbledygook into things that people can understand.
Brilliant. Well, thank you for coming on the show. It's been great.
Thank you so much for having me, Andrew. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
So Andrew, Alison's invisible gift about taking complex ideas and concepts and communicating them in ways that people can understand, fascinating. And I guess something as a dyslexic you can really relate to.
Yeah, I've got a strapline. I've got something I put on my LinkedIn page, and I've always said it to my clients as much as it annoys them. But I always say, I solve problems you didn't know you had in ways you couldn't understand. And although that sounds cocky, it's true, because as a dyslexic thinker, I see larger pictures than everyone else, and I process things different ways. There's always problems you can get over. And
if you can communicate in the right way, you know, the solution goes beyond itself. And that's kind of like, it's just what she's saying is the same as what I'm saying. I swear she could have taken it from my LinkedIn page.
That she did, buddy. But, you know,
you couldn't always
dream.
I could dream, yeah.
What do you think of her advice that you should only focus on things you can control?
Ah, probably my motto to life. People ask me all the time, why are you happy? Now, for everyone listening, I am, as much as you might not hear it that much on the podcast, I am insanely chirpy, happy person. And people always go, why are you happy? And I say, I let go of things I can't control. I think for a lot of people, and actually we spoke about that, is that a lot of people focus on the stuff that they can't control because it's easier than admitting that they should have done stuff where they can control it.
So true. Alison was an incredible guest. Thank you, if you're listening, for giving us your time. We really appreciate it. You can learn more about Alison, the work that she does, and check out some of her amazing books on her website, alisonedgar.com. We'll also link to that in this week's show notes. Andrew, where's the podcast going from here? Who's the next guest?
Next week, James, we are speaking to Edward Keelan, who is known as the dyslexic investor.
Wow. According to the notes that I've got here, Edward talks all things venture capital and tells us about the post that made him go viral. So I think that's probably about it for this week, don't you?
Indeed.
In the meantime, thank you guys for listening to The Invisible Gift. Where can they write to you if they would like to share their thoughts, their stories, their experience, their invisible gift? Comments. We love hearing from you guys.
So there's loads of places to contact me, but the one I really love would be if you could email me at andrew@theinvisiblegift.com.
And you can also obviously check out the website, theinvisiblegift.com. Smash that follow button wherever you listen to your podcast app so you know when the next episode comes out. It means the world to us. If you do have time to rate or review the podcast, we would also really appreciate that. And we will see you next week.
See you later. Have a great week. Just a couple of quick notes before we go. They're important ones. You've been listening to the Invisible Gift podcast, presented by me, Andrew Kitley, and produced by One Fine Play. From One Fine Play, James Bishop is the executive producer. Connor Foley is the editorial producer and researcher. Special thanks to Christina, Izzy, and the Cube Studios. Thank you for listening to the Invisible Gift podcast.